And this is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Good morning and welcome to our show. In this part of the program, we will be talking about the Middle East once again, some of the issues that have been raised in the Gulf War, and probably most specifically about the Arab-Israeli conflict. And our guest for the program this morning is Joan Peters. She is Vice President of the National Committee on American Foreign Policy. She is an historian and investigative reporter and is the author of a book published by Harper and Row in 1984, entitled From Time Immemorial, looking at the Arab-Israeli conflict. The book now is out of print, I'm told. However, if you should be interested in reading it, you probably will be able to find it in your local library.
It's also going to be back in print, I think, by the end of this year.
You think it will be back in print?
Well, there are a lot of very interested parties in doing it.
Okay.
It's a matter of getting it done.
So then it may well be that you would be able to find new copies of the book. Our guest this morning is here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. She gave a talk last night on the topic and was good enough to come over and spend some time with us here this morning. Let me tell you a little bit more about her background. She is now in her 10th year as Vice President of the National Committee on American Foreign Policy. She also sits on the editorial board of the American Foreign Policy Newsletter. She spent some time working as a reporter for the Chicago Daily News. She has also written and produced network news documentaries for CBS and has been a PBS, a public broadcasting system, contributing editor on foreign affairs. She also served as a consultant to the White House on Arab-Israeli affairs during 1977. That's during the Carter administration. Her book has received a number of awards, including the prestigious National Jewish Book Award in 1985. And we're pleased to have her with us this morning. Let me give you our telephone number if you would like to give us a call. We certainly welcome your comments and questions. Our local number here is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. The numbers are close, but they're not exactly the same. 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. And also, before we get started here, let me just remind you of one thing. We have received word that President Bush will be holding a news conference at the White House at approximately 11:45 our time. He'll have an opening statement, and then we'll take questions. NPR will be providing live coverage, and we will carry this news conference. So it is possible that we might have our time shortened up a bit here on Focus. However, also, we know that the start times on some of these events can be fluid, and so it's possible it may not start right at 11:45, and we will have our customary time. In any case, we'll talk here as long as we can, and when the president begins, you will be able to hear him here on AM 580. Thank you very much for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Certainly, I think there is the hope and expectation that now that the war is over, that some of the other troubling issues in the Middle East can be resolved. And in fact, I think that there are a lot of people who expect that the number one issue is going to be the status and future of the Palestinians.
Why do you think it's still going to be number one? Do you think they deserve to be rewarded because they sided with Saddam Hussein?
I'm not saying that I think that it should.
Uh-huh.
I am saying
that.
Do you think
that's why they're... it seems strange to me. Doesn't it seem strange to you that suddenly it's going to be upped to the number one priority?
Well, I think that a lot of people see it as first being a precipitating event, or at least a contributing factor to the Gulf War, and something that has been such a problem for a long time that, I think sort of people are tired
about it. How did the problem contribute to the Gulf War? I think that when Saddam Hussein went into Kuwait, he went in for the money and the oil and the power. I don't think it had a bloody thing to do with
Palestinians. Well, but it gave him another card to play and a way to muddy the waters.
Oh, yes, you're right. You mean he used it after he did it to try and get out of it.
It just sort of... I think there is a perception on a lot of people's part that it somehow just made things even more, made what was already a difficult situation even more difficult. And if that didn't exist, perhaps it would have made things a little bit easier.
Oh, I think not. Respectfully, Jay Peters dissenting, I think it was irrelevant. I think the Palestinian problem in the context of the Saddam Hussein invasion of Kuwait, and if he had been given a chance, Saudi Arabia too, was absolutely irrelevant, because the Palestinian problem is a device of the Arab countries. They've used these poor, hapless people as human bombs for every possible crisis that comes up. And they've used them to keep Israel from becoming a peaceful place. They, I believe, are guilty and culprits to a great extent where the Arab Palestinians are concerned.
Okay. Well, let me go back to the point about, you know, the place of this issue on the international agenda. I suppose, as much as anybody else, am influenced by all of the various pundits and analysts and journalists and everybody that one hears from. Now we've had this big cascade of this stuff after the war, and that's what one hears a great deal. That, well, okay, now that we got this taken care of, now the thing to deal with is the status of the Palestinians. Now, I mean, do you think that in fact that won't be the big issue?
I think it won't. I think that will be relegated to its proper place in order of the things that need to be addressed.
Well, then let me ask you what you think are the things that need to be addressed.
There are very many. I would say that the first thing we need to address is how we can prevent, again, the kind of sales that our government and all the Western governments of the world gave to Saddam Hussein. I think we have to enforce legally some kind of constraints so that it is illegal. It is a crime to sell the kinds of unconventional weapons and the fierce toys that they were selling for purposes of greed to Saddam Hussein.
And should that apply not just to Iraq but to all of the other nations of the region?
Absolutely. At the moment, Libya and Syria, nobody's talking about what's going into Libya and Syria now. And some of the things that are there and still going in are quite frightening, as a matter of fact. They have missiles, for example, from China that can go 600 kilometers. Very important. They have gas of all kinds. They have enormous numbers of new weapons that we know nothing about.
Mm-hmm. We do have one caller here who's been waiting for quite a bit here. We might as well go ahead and bring them into the discussion. Let me also reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Joan Peters. She is Vice President of the National Committee on American Foreign Policy and is author of a book on the Arab-Israeli conflict entitled From Time Immemorial. Let me just take a minute to ask you about
Sure. The
National Committee on American Foreign Policy, what the aims of the organization are.
Okay. It was founded in 1974 by Professor Hans Morgenthau, a very famous political scientist who is now dead, from the University of Chicago. Professor Morgenthau was a world-renowned political scientist who was the mentor of Henry Kissinger. And Henry Kissinger's policies in 1974 were so outrageous to Professor Morgenthau that he formed this organization quite literally to attack the policies of Kissinger when he was Secretary of State. At that time, he was concerned about the Soviet policies that we had here and the Middle East policies, and he wanted to address them. Since then, the organization has grown to some extent. It has a lot of State Department people, former ambassadors, former civil servants, former writers and present writers and ambassadors, and is a very, I think, interesting body of people. The difference between us and probably most of the people in such organizations in New York, we are based in New York, but we take positions on issues. We do fact-finding missions, we do conferences, we do a lot of research, and then we take a position. And the positions range everywhere, all over the board. It's nonpartisan.
But the hope of the organization is that you manage to persuade people in government of the rightness of your of your position and have
yes.
some sort of influence on
yes.
on policy.
And if not always having the influence, at least we get heard and to a great extent.
Okay, good. We have now a couple of callers here ready to go, and we'll start with line number one. Hello.
Hi, Mrs. Peters. I was wondering if you could address, now that the U.S. has a key strength in the Middle East, what our role might be and what you see as the key to Israeli-Arab peace.
Oh, that's a very good question. We do have a superior power role at this moment in the world. Although I don't believe our own government, perhaps our own mechanisms like the State Department, they're not really aware of it yet. We have the power I think we have relegated all other powers to second-class powers. If we realize that, we can have a tremendous influence on what goes on in the Middle East now. I think, primarily, I will give you a little example. I spoke with President Sadat several times before he died, and I became a great admirer of President Sadat because he understood something pivotal. He walked over the water to Jerusalem in a period of time when President Carter was planning an international conference. He wanted to persuade President Carter not to, and he couldn't. So he simply bypassed the American government, went to Israel, and made peace. The American government was furious at first, and then they finally joined it. But the bilateral negotiations, the one-on-one President Sadat believed in, I believe, are the only way that there will be an Arab-Israeli peace. And I believe that even though President Sadat was assassinated for doing it, his martyrdom is assured, because today Egypt and Israel are at peace.
Can I just follow up on
sure,
that? With,
sure.
With hopefully a growing peace between Israel and the Arab nations, where do you see the future of the Palestinian issue going?
It's another good question. The really important factor that created the Palestinian problem was the absolute resoluteness with which the Arab countries refused to treat them like human beings. They insisted that they remain in camps. There were offers of dignity and citizenship, as there were for hundreds of millions of other refugees after the Second World War. And those poor people, at least a lot of them, were kept in the camps because, as the Syrian Minister of Agriculture told me not too long ago, they had to keep them in camps because they wanted to keep their hatred directed against Israel. It's the breeding of human bombs. And I believe that if the Arab family comes to terms and peace with Israel, finally, which I think there is a possibility that it might happen, then a lot of the impetus to keep the, as the Syrian told me, to keep the hatred directed against Israel of the Palestinian people will be, I hope, dissipated, and there will be a possible solution.
Thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. Well, let me ask you to go a step further then, and then what's to become of these people, especially those people who are living in what are called the occupied territories? Will they stay there, or were you suggesting that they should somehow be repatriated to any place where they might have roots?
I think that's their problem, and only they have a right to talk about where they're going to be. I think that must be, however, discussed with their partners in the Middle East. I don't believe that I have a right, sitting here in Illinois, to talk about where anybody ought to be living. I know that they really know that they're not going to be able to destroy the small nation state of Israel so that they can go there, even though they were screaming on the rooftops, gas the Zionists, and they were saying they wanted Tel Aviv and not just Hebron. We really must know that they know that they're not going to have Tel Aviv. And I think what they decide will have a great deal to do with how the Americans treat these bilateral individual peace treaties that must be gotten before there can be any real peace. Mm.
Is there any reason to expect that there would be a possibility of an independent Palestinian state in some of that territory there?
I don't think that's going to satisfy any Palestinian who is now militant and claiming to invoke the charter of the PLO. I think there's going to be a new process. I heard Kuwait's ambassador this morning. It was a very interesting statement he made. He said they had to get different leadership, more moderate, for the PLO, or for the Palestinians. No, he said that Arafat and the PLO were not the choice for leadership anymore, that the Palestinian people needed a more moderate one, which is I think, a kind of buzzword for that they're going to have to change their tune. I think it's exciting. I think we may see the beginning of peace.
So do you really think that the fact that Arafat backed Saddam Hussein really means that that he's finished now?
Well, I think an awful lot of people in this country who saw them cheering the Scuds going into Saudi Arabia and into Israel, and at the time that we lost, how many soldiers did we lose in the last Scud missile? In
28.
And how many homes that were destroyed in Israel, how many people injured? I don't think that they're going to get much public opinion in this country again for a group of people who literally were cheering on the enemy who has been just defeated by the United States.
Well, we have some other callers here. Let's go on. Next caller is line number two. Hello.
Oh, well, David, I think I'll have to start out by being as antagonistic as your guest was to you in the first part. I think you're being rather complicit by using the expression repatriate. The Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza can't be repatriated anywhere because they are in the land of their birth. There is no question about that, despite your guest's revisionist history. She has even undermined Carter's Camp David process, implying that Carter had nothing to do with it. It was his strong determination to try to broker some kind of agreement between any of the parties that facilitated Sadat's trip to Jerusalem. There is no question about that, though.
There's a great question about it, because I was in Washington at the time, and I can tell you that when President Sadat walked over the water and went to Jerusalem, I flew there. Nobody knew about it in Washington. It was done totally unpredictably, and there was a lot of consternation in the United States because they didn't know.
In your camp, perhaps, but there was a long-standing commitment.
My camp was the official camp
to facilitate some kind of agreement. And
they were trying to push an international conference.
It wouldn't have happened.
No, they were trying to push an international conference, you see, and that was what President Sadat was very much against, because he understood all of the pitfalls from such a thing. And it was very brilliant of him, I think, what he actually did.
Well, turning to your revisionist history about the demographics of Palestine.
Well, it's no more revisionist than the history I just told you.
Hold up, both of you, please. Look, I want to give both of you an opportunity to respond to each other's points, but we can't do it if everybody's talking at once.
I know, but I can't remember one insult after another. I have to take, when you say revisionist history, it means you've made something up, and I didn't. I have multiple sources for everything in the book. I'll never remember how to answer him if I don't do it at the time he calls me a name.
Well, let me, I didn't call you a name, I just said you produced a revisionist history.
Well, now revisionist history means you made it up.
And that's what Anthony Lewis says in the New York Times.
Now, did you read the responses?
Go ahead, caller.
The quote from Anthony Lewis's column is, "Mrs. Peters' evidence, in quotes, is cooked."
Yes, but that's only Anthony Lewis. There is also the...
Yehoshua Porus,
yes,
of Hebrew University, said that you were mythologizing history, and neither Zionism nor history gains from mythologizing history.
Okay, then now I'll give you, just to settle the even-handedness of it, Barbara Tuchman said the book was a historical event in itself. Ambassador Andrew Biddle Duke said it was a book that must be read by everyone concerned with the Middle East. The Christian Century said it was the most thoroughly researched and solidly documented work on the Arab-Jewish conflict, a book that smashes conventional wisdom.
Well, rather than trade endorsements or condemnation, maybe, caller, can you ask a specific question that goes to the heart,
yes,
of your problem with the book?
Well, as Yehoshua Porus points out in his review in the New York Review of Books, I believe it was December of 85, and a review that was sat on for 9 months because people were too afraid to publish it because of all of this bravura about your book to begin with.
From whom? Who was the bravura from?
Excuse me?
What do you mean by bravura?
One you just cited.
Oh, I think you're speaking about the New York Times reviews and those things when you say bravura. All those good reviews, is that what you mean? Because Poroth in Israel was against the book, is that what you mean?
That's a fair characterization.
Right. He was very much against it. He and Edward Said, who is one of the founders of the PNC, Palestine National Council. There were several detractors. They tried to do a disinformation campaign. In fact, it not only didn't succeed, but Mr. Porath was responsible for the book being published in Hebrew. It's been printed, it's in the third printing now. It's being used as a textbook in Israel. And I was honored to be the honoree at the Haifa University conference on the subject of my book last year, in actually November of 1989. So as for that disinformation, which is in Anthony Lewis's column, I think I ought to correct that in front.
Well, how are you going to do it when Porath says that, of course...
I just did.
I mean,
I wasn't disputing that Porath does not like my book. However, his scholarship in his review of my book was completely incorrect, as Professor Mazar at the University of Chicago has verified. He wrote me a letter, and I'll be happy to read it to you if you'd like.
No, thanks. Do you have any other callers, or can I do a follow-up?
Well, I do have one other person, but go ahead. I still think we haven't really gotten to the heart of the contention that you were raising. Because if people have not read the book or really they're not familiar with this, they're not going to have any idea what it is that you two are
talking about. But does this gentleman read the book? Have you read the book that you're speaking about?
I've read Norman Finkelstein's citation.
Have you read the book?
Citations.
No, but I wanted to know if you've read the book because you're speaking of it only in terms of, you're speaking of the disinformation campaign, and you're obviously a spokesman for that. Have you ever read the book?
I've read sections of it.
Sections of it.
I've used Norman Finkelstein's very elaborate tables showing how your references
Norman
to your appendix in the back of the book do not even are not even fair restatements of the material.
Well, would you do me a kindness? Would you, sir, read the book and then decide for yourself whether that disinformation campaign was inventing of numbers? Because I have letters which were published by the New York Times, incidentally, from the top demographers in the country and the editor of the New Republic. All of them were published in the New York Times because they had published Norman Finkelstein's letter. And Norman Finkelstein is Noam Chomsky's puppet. He thanked Noam Chomsky when he did this.
That's an argument if I've ever heard one.
No, I will go on.
On the table, the bit of information that Anthony Lewis produces in his column, There Were No Indians, from January 13th, 1986, if anybody wants to look at it.
Absolutely. I hope they'll also look at the...
Can I present it?
I want them also to know that they can look at a column by Martin Peretz in the New York Times as well, which answers that letter.
I would like to know what was the published date of your response to Joshua Porath in the New York Review of Books. But let me present rather than trading these names back and forth. One of the issues that is presented by Anthony Lewis is the idea that you're saying that there were 60,000 Jews in Palestine, as opposed to 92,000 Jews in 1893, but that the material that Porath cites shows that there were less than 10,000, as opposed to a third of a million.
You're citing apples and oranges. Those numbers don't have any comparison. But I have his, as it happens, someone passed out that, which is only a coincidence. I'm sure that you happen to have that one. But there is... at my lecture yesterday, they happened to pass out this Anthony Lewis article. And I must say that it's very sad for Anthony Lewis that he took whole cloth, a handout from Edward Said, because all of the things he cites were absolutely inaccurate. He never even opened my book.
Yehoshua Porath is who he took the page from. Let's get it straight.
Yes, well, I have Yehoshua.
Publish it after that.
Yehoshua Porath didn't even know how Palestine was divided. His whole article was an emotional harangue because the students in Israel have been challenging his book on the Palestinian nationalism movement by using mine. For some reason, the man is bonkers on the subject of Joan Peters. He screams when my name is mentioned, but there are many other professors in Israel who use my book, who are freely teaching with it, and the book is in its third printing, being used at universities throughout the country. Naturally, There is a lot of academic pettiness. There are a lot of people who cannot stand being challenged, especially by me, because I'm a self-styled historian, as Barbara Tuchman called me, like she was. And I don't have the academic teaching career that these people do. They have vested interests. And Mr. Porath, as a matter of fact, lately has written in a little different way since the Palestinians were cheering the Scuds.
Just as a last rejoinder, I'll let someone else have a chance. It's the reason why people respond to you by going bonkers is because you have been championing the idea of mass deportation of the Palestinians from their homeland.
But you see, that's your...
And the Homeland Party ever were even thought of. Goodbye.
But you must understand that there is no such thing as deportation in my book. I give more Arabs as natural and native citizens in my book than Anthony Lewis cited in his own column. That's how distorted the propaganda has become.
We are here about midway through our program, and perhaps I've let this exchange go on longer than I should. We have some other people here that we want to talk to, and it's possible, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, that we might have to finish up a little earlier than usual because President Bush will be holding a news conference at the White House, we're told, at 11:45 our time, so that's less than 15 minutes from now. It's possible they may not start on time, so we may be able to go longer. But I just want to warn people who are listening, it's a chance we might have to finish early. I'm sure a lot of people are going to be confused if they're not familiar with your book or you're not familiar with the argument that you make in it. Can you give like a real thumbnail sketch? And then I want to get to some other callers too. Or basically the central point that you're trying to make and with the book.
The central point of the book is how many layered and unknown the traditions are that have created the Arab-Israeli conflict. Part of that central point, which is a complex issue, is the hatred toward not just Jews, but Christians as well in the Middle East. I think it became much clearer because of this Gulf War, unfortunately. The example of using the non-Muslim as infidel for whatever purposes plays an enormous role in today's Middle East conflict. There are layer upon layer of traditions that are, like the Intifada, for example. It's not an aberration that just happened because of the West Bank 3 years ago. The Intifadas have been tradition in that part of the world from time immemorial. The whipping up of people into fierce emotions so that they would attack. It's rioting by another name. There are so many unknown traditions that are important. I think perhaps the use of numbers to pad political issues and to create a more favorable political position has been used in the Middle East for at least 100 years, probably more, so that many genuinely and completely impoverished Arabs who were living in other countries were encouraged to go to the Arab refugee camps at the time of the 1948 war, according to the UN documents. That's not revisionist history. It's simply in the libraries, the archives, there's plentiful evidence that these were very unfortunately impoverished people who were given an opportunity which seemed far better than the homelessness and the foodlessness that they had in their Arab countries where they had no work. It still happens. They're still moving in the Middle East. It's part of a tradition. And when I was at the UN, I remember that one of the things that really didn't jibe for me, and I did start my book trying to... I was an old civil rights activist. I had been in Montgomery and in Greenwood, Mississippi, and I completely related my civil rights activities and my experience to the Palestinian, which was called the Arab refugee problem at that time. That was in the early 70s, and it was not yet, the new nomenclature had not yet been disseminated. There was an Arab refugee problem, and the Israelis were totally responsible for it. That's the way I was perceiving the subject. And when I went to the camps, I saw the Kalashnikovs, I saw the little kids who were handing out the Kalashnikovs in the PLO camps, and I thought, this has got to be righted, much in the same way that I thought it had to be righted when I saw blacks having to go to the back of the bus or not being able to vote just because of what they were. But what I found out was that it was the hatred of the Arab world in general that was refusing to let these people become citizens of other countries, in many cases, countries where they had just come from because of the poverty. They had come because the camps looked good. True, they were refugee camps, but they became a symbol of wealth to an impoverished person who had no work and no food and no home. Suddenly, they had ration cards. They had homes to live in. Some of the camps were not so bad. Some of them are purposely kept in a state of real dishevelment because it's to show that they're living badly. And these people are the most militant of all because they're in a state of constant hatred. And the Syrian who told me I had to keep, you know, he said, we have to keep the hatred of the Palestinians directed against Israel, was speaking, in fact, of using these people as a physical weapon. I found that out slowly. I backed away from the material often. What really got me was when I found a document in the United Nations, not once, but twice, because the first time I really didn't believe it. And I thought, it can't be true, because if it was true, somebody would have questioned it. But nobody did. And what really was stated was the following. The definition for an Arab refugee from Israel was different than the definitions of all other refugees from all other areas of the world. They had amended the definition, and it said so. And what was the definition of the... Do you know what the definition of the refugees is in the rest of the world?
It has something to do with their period of residence.
Exactly. Right? Yes, you're so right. Most people don't know that. It has to do with a long-lived residency and the need to flee in fear of life or for fear of families' lives and for all good reasons pertaining to threat. But it has a very stable clause about the long-lived residency. In the case of the Arab refugees from Israel, they changed that to 2 years. And you simply cannot fathom that at the same time they can both have been there from time immemorial, a landed, settled people, and at the same time be the same nomadic people we studied romantically in high school. And in fact, a number of people so great that they had to change the UN definition for it. They wouldn't have changed it for a few. So I went back and I asked a lot of questions. And I lost the publisher I had going in because the outline was totally changed. It was going to take me at least another 2 or 3 years. It ended up taking me 10 altogether. But I had to start over because the evidence I found had blown away all the assumptions that I had created from all the experts and all the documents from all the State Department handouts that I'd gotten in my reporting days.
We may only have another 5 minutes. I'm not sure. As we have told you before, President Bush is going to be holding a press conference this morning, scheduled to begin in about 5 minutes. We will be carrying that live. It's possible they won't start on time, so we'll go as long as we can until the president begins, and then we'll want to bring that to you. We're talking this morning with Joan Peters, Vice President of the National Committee on American Foreign Policy and also author of the book From Time Immemorial. My lines here are full. We'll try to get in as many people as we can before we have to go to the president. We'll go here to line number one next. Hello.
Yes. My question is, how do you deal with the displacement of the Arabs from Israel, especially the West Bank? I mean, these were Palestinians. This was their homeland. And to deny this is incorrect. How are you going to deal with the question, the way the Israeli government is trying to displace the Arabs from their land?
Where are they displacing them, sir?
They're trying to displace them on the West Bank.
Where are they displacing them? You mean because there are Jews there?
The Jews are trying to displace the Palestinians.
You mean the Jews who have moved into the West Bank?
And the government's policy is proposed to displace the Jews, the Arabs, from the West Bank.
I think that they're the only government in the Middle East that hasn't displaced anybody from the West Bank. As far as I know, I know that in Egypt they've expelled a lot of Palestinians now. I know that Kuwait...
I'm dealing with Israel.
No, I'm saying that... I know, but in order to make my point, I'm trying to use a frame of reference, sir. And that is that I think that most of the countries in the Middle East now are displacing. Israel hasn't, that I know of, except they did deport four who were guilty of bombing. I don't think that's considered displacement, although there has been a false charge of displacement for generations, long before Israel.
Okay, we can disagree on this, but next question is, how do you deal...
I thought there was only one. I think we were going to...
How do you deal with the atrocities that Israel is committing against the Arabs? How do you deal with the atrocities?
What atrocities are you speaking of?
You don't think there are atrocities against the Arabs?
Are you...
The killing of the people?
I'm asking
about what is common knowledge in the newspaper that anybody would read.
I don't believe newspapers.
Purposefully is killing Arabs, no different than South Africa has killed the blacks.
Have you seen lately anything in the newspapers telling about the atrocities that are committed in Israel?
Well, conveniently, we have a war in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait.
Why is the war in Saudi Arabia
convenient? It's displacing our interest from what's going on in Israel with the West Bank, and you know that.
Golly, you sound like you have a lot of hatred in you.
No, I'm talking about you.
I really wonder about you.
You're just an apologist. That's all you are.
I wonder about
the reality.
I'm an apologist for the
peace. You could work for the South African government the way you are.
South African.
Yes, you could work for the South African.
I beg your pardon.
Does your book sell in the South African?
I beg your pardon.
What is the number of books sell in South Africa?
I didn't sell a book in South Africa.
I bet you it sells very well because you're such an apologist for the Israeli government and the Israeli people. That
what makes
incredible.
You think that doesn't figure? I happen to be an old civil rights activist, and as a matter of fact, I am still involved in the black movement, and if I were anywhere in South Africa, it would not be with the government.
Well, if you think that the U.S. policies have not made the Arabs hate us, I think you've got a lot of problems in your scholarship.
What did you say about that? I never heard that until
now. The U.S. policies towards the Arabs have not made the Arabs hate us. I think you've got a lot of problem in your scholarship.
I think they were just defending the Arabs. I don't understand your point, sir. I'm afraid you need a little homework.
No, I think you do, and the next thing I'm going to find out is that Kirkpatrick's parents were black.
Oh, my, this poor man is full of hatred. Do you get a lot like that?
I think I'll just go on. Let's say we'll go on to another caller. I'll go to our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello, David?
Yes.
I would like to say that you're not going to change anybody's minds, or she's not going to change anybody, but the people, two previous callers, their minds were made up the day they were born, and they've had history on their side for the last 10,000 years. Hate the Jew, hate the Jew. I'd like to ask Ms. Peters and anybody else who might be listening, have they ever seen a peace demonstration by the Arabs? Have they ever seen anything like that? That's number one. Number two,
it's a good question.
These people who are always saying that...